On September 3, 1939, the United Kingdom declared war on Germany. So did the Viceroy of India on behalf of nearly 400 million subjects of the British Empire. The colony was vital to the defence of British interests around the world. It sat in the middle of the supply and communication route that stretched from the United Kingdom through the Suez Canal or around the Cape of Good Hope and across the Indian Ocean to Singapore, Australia and New Zealand. Throughout World War II, ships would transport food, armaments and troops from the colonies and dominions on the periphery of the Indian Ocean to the United Kingdom, as well as to war theatres around the Mediterranean Sea or in Southeast Asia. The Indian population would play a significant role in the war. Of the colony's pre-war budget, a third went toward defence, and that fraction had increased to two-fifths by 1939. The Indian Army's primary domestic tasks were to guard the northwestern border against Soviet incursions southward across Afghanistan and to ensure internal security. Just as important, this army was ideally situated to defend British dependencies in the Middle East, Africa, and Southeast Asia, and could be dispatched to diverse theatres under direct orders from London. At the start of the war, it comprised 43,500 British and 131,000 Indian troops, some of whom had already been sent to Egypt and Singapore. Churchill, then a member of the War Cabinet, recommended that a further 60,000 British troops be sent to India to maintain internal security and complete their training, while at least 40,000 trained troops be brought back. While being trained, the white soldiers would forestall any uprising among the increasingly restive population of Indians intent on independence. "I was kept for this job," Churchill confided to his doctor when he succeeded Neville Chamberlain as Prime Minister on May 10, 1940. Over his 65 years, Churchill had repeatedly placed himself in danger and had had several narrow escapes, which had bolstered his profound conviction that he was destined for a mighty task. It had taken him most of his life to discover what that something was, to lead the island race, as he would entitle his History of the British, in a great struggle. "I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial," Churchill wrote of his accession to the most powerful position in the British Empire. 3 days after his appointment, he addressed the Parliament and the nation, promising nothing but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. The aim of the war, he declared, was victory, victory at all costs, for without victory there is no survival. Let that be realised. No survival for the British Empire, no survival for all that the British Empire has stood for, no survival for the urge and impulse of the ages that mankind will move forward towards its goal. The Prime Minister would not only defend the British Isles from invasion and subjugation by Hitler's armies, he would safeguard its vast and sprawling empire. But India, like some of the other colonies and dominions, would sacrifice at least as much as the United Kingdom did in the defence of an empire from which it had long been struggling to break free. To make sure India obeyed him and did its part to support the war, Churchill needed a lieutenant with a record of firmness in dealing with colonies. The very day he gave his rousing blood, toil, tears and sweat peroration, the Prime Minister summoned the respected elder statesman, Leopold S. Amory, and asked him to serve as Secretary of State for India. Amory was bitterly disappointed by the request. He was 66, a year older than Churchill, and up to that point his career had broadly paralleled that of the Prime Minister. Amory had covered the Boer War as a correspondent, had served in World War I, and had subsequently been appointed First Lord of the Admiralty and Colonial Secretary. At the very least, he had expected a significant role in the War Cabinet helping to direct the war effort. It was even said that if Amory had been half a head taller and his speeches half an hour shorter, he might have become Prime Minister himself. Amory had also just played a central role in the Tory party mutiny that had brought down Chamberlain and installed Churchill. A week earlier, he had denounced Chamberlain from the floor of the Parliament. "You have sat too long here for any good you have been doing," Amory had declaimed, invoking the words of Oliver Cromwell, the 17th-century British leader who had deposed and killed King Charles I. "Depart, I say, and let us have done with you. In the name of God, go." Amory protested to Churchill that he was sidetracking me from the real conduct of the war. "Not so," the Prime Minister responded. "It was important to ensure that India contribute as much as possible to the war, which might even move east." Amory was not persuaded, and believed that Chamberlain had urged against his appointment to the War Cabinet. Historian William Roger Louis holds, however, that by giving him a relatively subordinate role, Churchill sought to contain a potential rival, one reputed to be a man of integrity and judgment who had the courage to speak his convictions regardless of consequence. Eventually, the patriot in Amory prevailed, even as he maintained a private hope that a cabinet reshuffle would bring him closer to power. He accepted the position. The new Secretary of State for India rapidly put mechanisms in place to utilize Indian supplies to the utmost, as he described in his diary, and moved to impart to the Marquess of Linlithgow the Viceroy in New Delhi, emergency powers of arrest and detention, control of the press, prohibition of seditious groups, and so on. "My whole conception is that of India humming from end to end with activity in munitions and supply production, and at the same time with the bustle of men training for active service of one sort or another, the first operation largely paying for the cost of the second," Amory explained to Linlithgow. The Indian Army was slated to play a crucial role in the war, and in June 1940 the Prime Minister directed Amory to ensure that additional divisions were shipped westward. "The fact that we are somewhat reducing the quality of our British garrisons in India makes it all the more desirable that a larger number of Indian troops should also be employed outside India," Churchill explained. "That is, because recent recruits from the United Kingdom who were in need of training were replacing more experienced white troops in India, the latter were either returning home to defend Britain or moving to the war theatres, any mutiny by the native soldiers would be all the more difficult to quell. So India's internal security required that as many of the sepoys as possible should also be abroad. Moreover," Churchill continued, "it appeared that the war would spread to the Middle East, and the climate of Iraq, Palestine, and Egypt are well suited to Indian troops." The Prime Minister's greater apprehension of a mutiny than of an external attack would mean that when Japanese forces suddenly and ominously arrived at India's eastern border in March 1942, the colony's most highly trained and best equipped divisions would be on another continent. Apart from supplying soldiers for some of the toughest combat in countries around the Mediterranean Sea, India was designated to provide the bulk of supplies for those theatres. Starting in May, Amory oversaw the effort to ship from India around 40,000 tons of grain per month, a tenth of its railway engines and carriages, and even railway tracks uprooted from less important train lines. The colony's entire commercial production of timber, woolen textiles and leather goods, and three-quarters of its steel and cement production would be required for the war. Factories near Calcutta were soon turning out ammunition, grenades, bombs, guns, and other weaponry. Bombay's mills were producing uniforms and parachutes, while plants all over the country were contributing boots, jeep bodies and chassis, machine parts, and hundreds of ancillary items such as binoculars, for which the need had suddenly swelled. Apart from the United Kingdom itself, India would become the largest contributor to the Empire's war, providing goods and services worth more than £2 billion. Leopold Amory had not visited India since he had left it as a small child. He sought to travel there, to gauge firsthand the manifold problems with the war effort, but discovered that the Viceroy was too protective of his turf to acquiesce. Lord Linlithgow was an acknowledged expert on India, and had been Viceroy since 1936. Amory, being far less familiar with the colony's affairs, needed his cooperation. Yet, over a lifetime of service to the needs of the Empire, Amory had acquired a special skill, devising constitutions that ceded power to colonies in small and careful doses. Resolving to maximize India's contribution to the war, he decided to apply this expertise toward breaking the prevailing impasse with the country's nationalists. Among Indians, the advent of war had brought anxiety mingled with hope. Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, now 70, had retired from active politics because he was unhappy with the socialism propounded by younger leaders such as Jawaharlal Nehru and Subhas Chandra Bose. The attractive and erudite Nehru, who turned 50 in 1939, had long played a prominent role in the Indian National Congress. Early in his career, Nehru had been emotionally and ideologically close to Gandhi, but they had since diverged on a number of issues. Bose, who was 8 years younger than Nehru, was a passionate radical who had spent most of his adult life in prison or in exile because of his extreme antipathy to colonialism, which included, on more than one occasion, expressing a sympathetic interest in armed rebellion. Both Nehru and Bose asserted that India needed to be industrialized along socialist lines under the paternal guidance of a powerful state. Gandhi, in contrast, held that industrialization begat violence. It drew power away from individuals and toward large centralized entities, and it demanded the massive use of natural resources as well as expanding markets that could be acquired only by force. In the late 1930s, Gandhi had occupied himself with rejuvenating villages, believing that India's salvation lay in reviving cottage industries such as spinning, which would employ and thereby restore power to individuals in their homes. But World War II thrust upon him a moral challenge that would bring him back to the fore. In 1935, after a prolonged civil disobedience movement in India, a coalition government in London had granted limited powers of self-rule to the colony. Many members of the Labour Party were sympathetic to Indian aspirations, and even some Tory politicians held that Britain could not forever oppose some measure of self-government in the colony. But an earlier Viceroy of India, Lord Irwin, had explained to Amory that Indians could probably be appeased by some facade which will leave the essential mechanism of power still in our hands. Accordingly, by 1935, London's socialists and conservatives had hammered out a compromise. A franchise of around 30 million voters would elect Indian ministers to run the provinces and send a few representatives to the Viceroy's Executive Council in New Delhi. The Viceroy, along with governors in the provinces, would retain ultimate control over defence, finance, foreign affairs, and internal security. As a colleague explained at the time to Churchill, this constitution would allow Indians to rule the provinces as long as they do it properly and leave the governors absolutely free to take over the whole or any part of the administration themselves should the machine not function properly. The Indian National Congress contested the elections mandated by the 1935 Act and won handsomely. 8 provinces out of 11 gained Congress ministries. But 3 years later, the fiery Bose became president of the Congress and reiterated the call for independence. "Ours is a struggle not only against British imperialism, but against world imperialism as well, of which the former is the keystone," he declared. "We are, therefore, fighting not for the cause of India alone, but for humanity as well." As president, when Bose gazed at the thunderclouds of world war on the horizon, he perceived a silver lining. The conflict was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to wrest freedom for India. with the United Kingdom facing a mortal threat that left it utterly dependent on Indian men and materials, its leaders would be forced to give way to nationalists' demands. In early 1939, he trounced a candidate favoured by Gandhi to win re-election as Congress president. Gandhi described the election as a personal defeat. At his instructions, on February 22, 1939, almost the entire senior leadership of the Congress Party resigned their positions, denying the president any way to implement his ideas. Bose was deeply hurt by this public repudiation and fell ill. In the 1920s, while imprisoned in Burma on unspecified charges, he had acquired a mysterious fever that recurred in times of stress. Undeterred, he urged at his inaugural address, which his brother had to deliver, Bose being too sick, that London be handed an ultimatum. If the United Kingdom did not liberate India within a specified time limit, he had in mind 6 months, the Congress should begin a non-violent civil disobedience struggle with the objective of winning independence. Gandhi countered that civil disobedience would inevitably degenerate into civil war. "I smell violence in the air I breathe," he wrote to Bose. Communal tensions had escalated in recent years, and clashes between Muslim peasants and Hindu landowners, fueled by economic disputes, had already claimed many lives in eastern Bengal. At a meeting in September 1939, the differences among Gandhi, Bose, and Nehru broke into the open. Gandhi was horrified by the bloodshed unleashed by the Nazis and wanted to cooperate with aspects of the war effort. Bose asserted that both Germany and the United Kingdom were fighting for imperial stakes. He saw the war as amoral and urged that the Congress use it as an opportunity to wrest freedom. Nehru detested fascism, but he also felt that Indians had no compelling reason to participate in a war that would free others while leaving them colonized. His view prevailed in that the Indian National Congress asked the United Kingdom to clarify the ends to which the war would be fought. If the war is to defend the status quo, imperialist possessions, colonies, vested interests, and privilege, India can have nothing to do with it. If, however, the issue is democracy and a world order based on democracy, then India is intensely interested in it, the Congress announced. A free, democratic India will gladly associate herself with other free nations for mutual defence against aggression. In October, after consulting with the War Cabinet in London, Viceroy Linlithgow described British war aims as laying the foundation of a better international system, which will mean that war is not to be the inevitable lot of each succeeding generation. He did not mention democracy. After the war, he added, the 1935 Act could be modified to incorporate progress toward the ultimate goal of dominion status, but only if the concerns of India's many minorities could be met. A dominion, such as Australia or Canada, was a self-ruling entity linked commercially and militarily with the United Kingdom, and in 1929, Viceroy Irwin had announced that His Majesty's government desired such a status for India. Linlithgow's response now indicated to the nationalists that the British did not intend to fulfil this promise in the near future, if ever. It became clear to us that they did not want us as friends and colleagues, but as a slave people to do their bidding, asserted Nehru. In protest, on October 23, 1939, the Congress Party ordered its politicians to resign all the positions to which they had been elected. The Muslim League, which was headed by the lawyer Muhammad Ali Jinnah, celebrated the end of the Congress ministries with a day of deliverance and thanksgiving. Jinnah also promised the Muslim League support for the war effort, provided that the British recognised it as the only organisation that spoke for India's Muslims. For decades, the 62-year-old Jinnah had played a leading role in the Indian National Congress. He had departed in 1920 because he disliked Gandhi's religiosity. Jinnah had since come to regard the Congress as a Hindu organization because of the preponderance of Hindus in its leadership, which in his estimation made it insensitive to the concerns of Muslims. In the elections of 1937, however, the Muslim League had won only 4.8% of the Muslim vote, largely because some overwhelmingly Muslim regions, such as the Northwest Frontier Province, had returned Congress politicians. Subsequently, a triumphant Nehru had thwarted Jinnah's effort to get politicians from the Muslim League appointed as ministers in two provinces where the League had done relatively well. Indians would pay dearly for the resulting rift. The dual humiliation, at the polls and at Nehru's hands, had convinced Jinnah that the Muslim League could not coexist with the Congress. In an effort to boost the League's popularity, he began to appeal to Islamic nationalism. In February 1940, the Marquess of Zetland, who was then the Secretary of State for India, suggested to the War Cabinet that the cooperation of the Congress with the war effort be secured by an offer of Dominion status at war's end. Churchill, then First Lord of the Admiralty, and a vigorous presence on the War Cabinet, opposed the idea. He recommended instead a firm course that would keep the colony quiet for the duration of the war. Nor did he share the anxiety to encourage and promote unity among Hindu and Muslim communities. Disharmony would be more conducive to retaining the British Raj. According to the minutes of the War Cabinet meetings, Churchill warned that if amity among Indians were somehow to be achieved, its immediate result would be that the united communities would join in showing us the door. He regarded the Hindu-Muslim feud as the bulwark of British rule in India. Churchill's chain of reasoning hinged on the fact that the Indian National Congress, though it was secular in its principles, was nevertheless composed mainly of Hindus. If the Congress failed to agree to share power with the Muslim League, the British could claim that their relinquishing India was tantamount to abandoning a vulnerable Muslim minority to Hindu-majority rule. Churchill had developed this argument during a prolonged campaign he had conducted in the early 1930s against granting partial self-government to Indians. In a 1931 speech, he had described a religious riot in India in graphic terms. Women and children were butchered in circumstances of bestial barbarity, their mutilated, violated bodies strewing the streets for days. He had used the conflict to argue that only the British could keep the fanatics of India from one another's throats. By 1937, he had turned that argument on its head, stating in a letter to Viceroy Linlithgow that unity among Indians of different faiths was fundamentally injurious to British interests. As Churchill explained it, the United Kingdom's task in India, an expansive land that comprised several feuding groups, was similar to its role in Europe, to preserve the balance between these great masses and thus maintain our own control for our advantage and their salvation. Therefore, Churchill continued, I am not at all attracted by the prospect of one united India, which will show us the door. That the government of India might incline toward promoting harmony between Hindus and Muslims was, to my mind, distressing and repugnant in the last degree. Instead, Churchill hoped that the Muslims of the Northwest would combine into a front to combat the anti-British tendencies of the Congress. Strife between Hindus and Muslims would bolster the rationale that British rule over India, which Lord Randolph Churchill had described as a calming sheet of oil over turbulent waters, was as necessary as it had always been. Although Winston Churchill was not yet Prime Minister, his views on India were so vehement that they prevailed. The War Cabinet turned down Zetland's proposal. When in March 1940 the Muslim League introduced a fresh demand, a separate nation for Muslims to be named Pakistan or Land of the Pure, Churchill hailed the awakening of a new spirit of self-reliance and self-assertiveness on the part of the different communities of which the Muslim League's resolution was a sign. As the war dragged on and financial and political circumstances indicated that the United Kingdom could not control India for long after it was over, Churchill would conclude that partitioning the colony to create Pakistan provided the best chance of retaining British influence in South Asia. Leopold Amory had his own, and if anything more carefully considered, ideas on the future of the British Empire. He believed that it had to be modernized so that it could continue to benefit the United Kingdom. Force could not forever hold the colonies, he maintained. Loyalty to the crown was necessary, and it could be bought only by economic solidarity. He saw the colonies not as possessions to be grasped in a fist, but as extensions of England to be linked by handshakes. Amory was a leading advocate of imperial preference, a proposal by the then late statesman Joseph Chamberlain, who had envisioned a system of mutually helpful tariffs that would foster trade within the British Empire and fend off competition from the United States and Germany. As for India, Amory believed that it would sooner or later have to take its place in the imperial scheme as a dominion. But if Indians were to relinquish their stated goal of full independence and instead opt to remain within the empire as a dominion, their emancipation would have to be achieved without acrimony. Accordingly, Amory suggested to Linlithgow that he probe Gandhi's views about the prospect of Indians designing their own constitution, while offering a guarantee of dominion status within a year after a successful resolution of the war. The Congress would also get greater representation on the Viceroy's Executive Council. In return, the party would resume governing in the provinces and, most important, cooperate with the war effort. Linlithgow reported to Amory that Gandhi was responsive. The initiative ran headfirst into an immovable roadblock. Winston's passionately instinctive objection to anything that means giving self-government to India, as the Secretary of State for India recounted in his diary. Churchill charged that matters so disruptive should not have been brought up at a time when all our thoughts should be devoted to the defence of the island and to the victory of our cause. Amory argued that it was essential to gain the support of at least the moderate Indians. A feeling was abroad that we were relying on the continued absence of agreement between the two main communities to free us from the performance of our pledges, he had stated in his presentation to the War Cabinet. He had yet to realize that this was indeed the Prime Minister's strategy. Unless the British government acted to dispel this view, Amory continued, increasing resentment of colonial authorities and escalating hostility between the Congress and the Muslim League could ultimately lead to civil war. Should worse come to worst, he wrote to Churchill, we could not hold India, even in wartime, for another year, certainly not for another 5 years. In the end, Amory warned with remarkable prescience, a partition of India, like the partition of Ireland, and just as fruitful of future trouble, may be the only immediate solution. The Prime Minister would not be placated. On July 25, 1940, he attacked Amory so furiously in the War Cabinet that one member, Sir Alexander Cadogan, walked out in embarrassment. The next day, Amory went to 10 Downing Street to meet Churchill, who said he would sooner give up political life at once, or rather go out into the wilderness and fight, than to admit a revolution which meant the end of the imperial crown in India, Amory wrote in his diary. It was hopeless to try and point out to him that what I was suggesting was well within the four corners of pledges and statements made again and again, and could hardly be so revolutionary if Zetland at the India Office had proposed it months ago. The Prime Minister demanded that Amory show him all the telegrams he had sent to Linlithgow, in which he had freely expressed himself about Churchill, and perused them carefully, showing signs of agitation. I am afraid he will read and reread the telegrams and get more and more angry as he does so, and work himself up into a high mood of virtuous indignation, Amory sighed. His Majesty's government could not accept just any constitution drafted by a group of Indians, the Prime Minister ultimately informed the Viceroy. We should have to know beforehand what this body was and feel assured that it truly represented the broad masses of the leading Indian communities, including, of course, not only Hindus and Muslims, but the princes, the depressed classes, the Sikhs, the Anglo-Indians and others. The so-called depressed classes, whom Churchill also referred to as untouchables, were people of tribal origins or lower castes. Anglo-Indians were whites resident in India. Nor could the War Cabinet tie the hands of a post-war British Parliament by promising Dominion status under our free democratic system. Churchill asserted it was impossible to guarantee the attitude of a future House of Commons toward India. The Prime Minister's refusal to consider any move toward the colony's emancipation thwarted the possibility of meeting the wartime needs of the United Kingdom by the willing cooperation of Indian nationalists, and his determination to instead secure their compliance by divide and rule would disastrously deepen communal hostilities. The whole basis of our policy, as you have laid it down yourself, is that it is Indian divisions and not our refusal to surrender authority that is holding back India's march towards the declared goal, Amory wrote to the Prime Minister in April 1941. On that ground, I can continue to hold my own. That Winston Churchill was, for an instant, prepared to relinquish the post of Prime Minister to which he had aspired his entire life speaks to the depth of his attachment to India. A decade earlier, it had even induced Churchill to break with the Tory party on its decision to permit limited self-government in the colony. I have always said that the key to Winston is to realise that he is mid-Victorian. Steeped in the politics of his father's period and unable ever to get the modern point of view, Amory had written in 1929, after the two had had a long discussion on contemporary affairs. It is only his verbal exuberance and abounding vitality that conceal this elementary fact about him. At the time, Lord Irwin's promise of Dominion status for India had prompted Churchill to launch a forceful campaign to bolster his government's commitment to the Raj. Dominion status can certainly not be attained while India is a prey to fierce racial and religious dissensions, and when the withdrawal of British protection would mean the immediate resumption of medieval wars, he had warned in an article in the Daily Mail. Should His Majesty's government make any concessions at all, the nationalists would only be emboldened to ask for more. The truth is that Gandhiism and all it stands for will, sooner or later, have to be grappled with and finally crushed. It is no use trying to satisfy a tiger by feeding him with cat's meat. In 1935, when despite his furious five-year campaign, the new constitution for India had passed into law, Churchill denounced it as a monstrous monument of sham built by the pygmies, the latter including the leaders of the Tory party. A full third of the population of England would have to go down, out, or under if we ceased to be a great empire, he warned in an oblique, if exaggerated, reference to India's importance for the British economy. Churchill's image of India as the fountainhead of British prestige, prosperity and power derived in part from that of his own father. Lord Randolph had viewed the Taj Mahal by moonlight, an unequalled sight, and bagged a tiger from the back of an elephant, certainly the acme of sport. In 1885 and 1886, he had served as Secretary of State for India, in which capacity he had ordered the invasion of Upper Burma. Introducing his budget for India before the House of Commons, Lord Randolph had urged parliamentarians to take a more energetic interest in the colony, that most truly bright and precious gem in the crown of the Queen, the possession of which, more than that of all your colonial dominions, has raised in power, in resource, in wealth, and in authority, this small island home of ours far above the level of the majority of nations and of states, has placed it on an equality with, perhaps even in a position of superiority over, every other empire either of ancient or modern times. When his father died in 1895, the 20-year-old Winston had resolved to pursue his aims and vindicate his memory. As a cavalryman in India, Churchill had further pledged to devote my life to the protection of this great empire of ours. Winston Churchill had been bequeathed an imperial heritage simply by being born in 1874 at Blenheim Palace. Featuring grand vistas, giant portraits of ancestors, and gory scenes of battle frozen into stone, the palace was Queen Anne's reward to John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough, for achieving a glorious victory in Bavaria in 1704. But Winston's upbringing was as parsimonious of warmth as his heritage was opulent and intimidating. At the age of 7, he was sent to boarding school, where he became a paradox to his teachers, devouring novels meant for readers far older than he was, but remaining resolutely at the bottom of his form in virtually every academic subject. Where my reason, imagination, or interest were not engaged, I would not, or I could not, learn, Churchill explained. At Harrow, an elite institution that trained upper-class youths to become leading citizens of the empire, Winston, judged unable to learn Latin and Greek, had to sit through more English grammar than anyone else. Thus, I got into my bones the essential structure of the ordinary British sentence, which is a noble thing, he wrote in his autobiography, My Early Life. He would wield the power of language with immense facility and force. At the military academy, Sandhurst, Winston thrilled to the idea of battle and wondered if he would ever get to apply in combat all the martial strategy he was absorbing. It did seem such a pity that it all had to be make-believe, and that the age of wars between civilized nations had come to an end forever, he wrote in his memoir in the late 1920s, reminiscing about a time when war had still been glamorous. The battles that had bloodied Europe for centuries seemed past. Instead, the continent's various powers were completing the conquest and colonization of Asia and Africa. Luckily, however, there were still savages and barbarous peoples, such as Afghans and Zulus, to shoot at, Churchill remembered thinking as a cadet. In between practicing cavalry charges, the would-be officers would sit around hoping for at least an uprising so that we might have India to reconquer. In such an event, we should all get our commissions so much earlier and march about the plains of India and win medals and distinction and perhaps rise to very high command like Clive when quite young. Churchill travelled to India in 1896 as an officer of the 4th Queen's Own Hussars, a cavalry regiment. After 2 days and a glittering banquet in Bombay, he had formed a highly favourable opinion of the colony. He would write that he dropped off to sleep that second night with the keenest realisation of the great work which England was doing in India and of her high mission to rule these primitive but agreeable races for their welfare and our own. Churchill's cantonment in Bangalore was spacious, and the abundance of servants, one of whom would shave him at dawn while he lay half asleep in bed, made military life luxurious. He found India sensual, exotic, romantic. Snipe and snakes abound in the marshes, brilliant butterflies dance in the sunshine, and nautch girls by the light of the moon. Between games of polo, the young man devoured books that his father had favoured. I revelled in his essays, he wrote of Macaulay's stirring histories of Clive, Hastings, and other conquerors. Churchill also learned about nature's hierarchy from Charles Darwin, and about the perils of human fecundity from Reverend Thomas Malthus. And, as an act of filial piety and in preparation for a future career in politics, He read through every parliamentary debate in which his father had taken part. Even as he made up for the higher education he had missed, Churchill read only those works that reinforced his perspective on the world. He took straight to heart every sentiment that appealed and was rarely forced to consider both sides of an argument. Churchill acknowledged as much. I therefore adopted, quite early in life, a system of believing whatever I wanted to believe, he wrote, while at the same time leaving reason to pursue unfettered whatever paths she was capable of treading. This habit of thinking was evident to his contemporaries. An acquaintance complained in 1921, "He does not want to hear your views. He does not want to disturb the beautiful clarity of his thought by the tiresome reminders of the other side." Throughout his life, on India and myriad other topics, Churchill would cling to certain convictions with the tenacity of a bulldog, the figure that would long be associated with him. Only some lucky phrase, some form of words, some vivid image, as his friend Violet Asquith put it, could loosen its jaws. In 1897, a 2,000-mile train journey took Churchill to the foothills of the Himalayas. Those large, leather-lined Indian railway carriages, deeply shuttered and blinded from the blistering sun, and kept fairly cool by a circular wheel of wet straw, which one turned from time to time, were well adapted to the local conditions. He would recount 3 decades later, "I spent 5 days in a dark, padded, moving cell, reading mostly by lamplight or by some jealously admitted ray of glare." Perhaps because he was so absorbed in his reading, Churchill did not describe the landscapes he traversed or the famine raging at the time, described as the worst of the century, although that appellation would pass to the famine that began in 1899. Instead, the young man's upbringing, the tomes he perused, and the skirmishes to which he was headed would combine to frame his ideas about India. Malthus, Darwin, Macaulay, and pride in paternal inheritance would fuse into a comprehension of human destiny that would nowadays be called social Darwinism. Churchill stopped for a night at a military camp where he had a friend. Fellow officers inspired him with noble sentiments by singing, "Great White Mother, far across the sea, ruler of the empire may ever she be. Long may she reign, glorious and free, in the great white motherland." Churchill was going to the northwest frontier province, British India's border with Afghanistan. From the level plain of the valleys, the hills rise abruptly. Their steep and rugged slopes are thickly strewn with great rocks and covered with coarse, rank grass, he wrote in his first book, The Story of the Malakand Field Force, which described expeditions of the Indian Army against Pakhtun farmers. The rice fields along both banks of the stream display a broad, winding strip of vivid green. If the young man looked up from his books, that was because this stark paradise, with its splendid butterflies whose wings of blue and green change colour in the light like shot silk, was setting for a strife. British strategists had ordered an advance to the north, so as to claim mountain passes by which Russian forces might threaten the borders of India. Several tribes made their homes on this route, however, and they resisted the incursions on their territory. Writing of the Pakhtun tribesmen, Churchill declared, "Not because he is degraded, not because we covet his valleys, but because his actions interfere with the safety of our empire, he must be crushed." He was at the front line as a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, but he took enthusiastic part in skirmishes. "There is no reputation I cherish so keenly as to gain a reputation of personal courage," he wrote in a letter home. The 23-year-old had also surmised that his blow-by-blow accounts of the Empire's battles would give him the visibility necessary to establish a career in politics. Churchill would always carry with him certain lessons he learned in the frontier wars. He could be magnanimous in victory. After the fighting ended in the tribe's appeal for a truce, he pronounced the Pakhtuns to be a brave and warlike race. While the conflict raged, however, his hostility was absolute. "These tribesmen are among the most miserable and brutal creatures of the earth," he had opined about Pakhtuns just a week earlier. "Insofar as these valleys are purged from the pernicious vermin that infest them, so will the happiness of humanity be increased." He recounted in violent detail how the British commanding general, Sir Bindon Blood, ordered reprisals after an enemy attack on a military camp. "We proceeded systematically, village by village, and we destroyed the houses, filled up the wells, blew down the towers, cut down the great shady trees, burned the crops, and broke the reservoirs in punitive devastation." Churchill offered a defence of such scorched-earth tactics in Malakand, arguing that "it is only an unphilosophic mind that will hold it legitimate to take a man's life and illegitimate to destroy his property." Economic warfare was destined to become a key weapon in his arsenal of military tactics. In a sense, Churchill found his fortune in India. Malakand became a spectacular publishing success. "I had never been praised before," he would recall. "Now, even the Prince of Wales wrote to congratulate him." Having conquered many of his own deficiencies in India, Churchill soon left for other fields of battle. In South Africa, he helped save a trainload of soldiers from a Boer ambush, got captured by the enemy, and managed to escape. That adventure made him a household name, while the royalties accumulating from Malakand allowed him to support himself during his preparations to enter public life. At age 25, in September 1900, he was elected to the House of Commons. To Winston Churchill, the empire won by the valour of heroes such as General Robert Clive would always remain worth the blood of its noblest citizens. In his autobiography, he exhorted English youths to meet the challenge. "You must take your places in life's fighting line," he wrote. "Enter upon your inheritance, accept your responsibilities. Raise the glorious flag again. Advance them upon the new enemies, who constantly gather upon the front of the human army and have only to be assaulted to be overthrown. The world could not really be harmed by conquest, only renewed. She was made to be wooed and won by youth. She has lived and thrived only by repeated subjugations." In August 1940, after Churchill torpedoed Amory's proposals for granting India dominion status within a year after the war, the Viceroy issued a long statement to the effect that a body of suitably representative natives would be permitted to draw up a constitution at some unspecified point following the war. No minority group would be obliged to accept a government of which it disapproved. In effect, His Majesty's government was giving the Muslim League the power to determine the nature and pace of political advancement in India. Nehru described the offer as fantastic and absurd, and to no one's surprise, the Congress rejected it. Several of the party's leaders now urged Gandhi to sanction a civil disobedience movement protesting India's induction into the war. Gandhi refused. The Muslim League had signalled its intention to support the war, so he surmised the danger of clashes between independence-minded Hindus and pro-government Muslims to be high. Instead, and in fear and trembling at the horrors he envisaged erupting around him, Gandhi began nominating tried and tested individuals to offer satyagraha, or non-violent resistance, by means of seditious statements. Nehru was arrested on October 31, 1940, after giving three speeches urging the public to refuse to aid the government's war. "It was monstrous," Nehru declared when he was brought before the court, "that hundreds of millions of Indians should be commandeered into a war not of their choosing, and amazing and significant that this should be done in the name of freedom and self-determination and democracy." He was sentenced to 4 years' rigorous imprisonment. As the circle of those nominated for satyagraha expanded into the villages, the number of people convicted of sedition would rise to 25,000 by the summer of 1941. Gandhi himself remained free, an indication that the government considered this restrained protest to be insignificant. Should he have to be arrested, however, Churchill suspected he might resort to a hunger strike, a political weapon with which the British government had long experience. One standard procedure for thwarting the protesters, called cat and mouse, was to release them only to re-arrest them when they resumed eating. Churchill determined that Gandhi would not get this treatment. Amory wrote in his diary on November 21, 1940, that the Prime Minister was particularly anxious that I should ask Linlithgow to convey privately to Gandhi that we had no objections to his fasting to death if he wanted to. Subhas Bose was already in prison, having been arrested in July 1940. After failing to resolve his dispute with Gandhi, he had resigned the presidency of the Indian National Congress and returned to Calcutta, where he had once served as mayor. There he had planned a march on the Holwell Monument, which commemorated the Englishmen who had suffocated to death in 1756 after their imprisonment by Nawab Siraj-ud-Dowla. To many of the city's white residents, the monument recalled the brutality that had preceded and thereby necessitated the British Raj. To Bose, it was the symbol of our slavery and humiliation, and he resolved to tear it down. Gandhi's strategy of Satyagraha rested on the belief that an adversary would respond with pangs of conscience to evidence of the suffering he caused. Bose, in contrast, maintained that Britons were more likely to respond to material weapons than to spiritual ones. Bengalis had been excluded from the army on the ground that they were not sufficiently warlike or brave, Bose declared. And Viceroy Curzon had added injury to insult by summoning armed police to disperse peaceable protesters. In sheer despair, young men took to the bomb and the revolver, Bose asserted. The offspring of upper-class families had begun to assassinate British officials, and on the streets of Calcutta, youth responded with their fists to racial insults. And slowly, an impression gained ground that for the first time, the Bengali was being respected by the Britisher, Bose concluded. Violence demonstrated that the people of Bengal were not a race of cowards. On July 2, 1940, the day before the announced march, Bose was arrested under the Defence of India Act and taken to a Calcutta prison. After 4 months of watching political developments from behind bars, he resolved to not spend the rest of the war thus incapacitated and devised an escape plan. On November 29, he started fasting and in a few days grew dangerously weak. One individual may die for an idea, but that idea will, after his death, incarnate itself in a thousand lives, he wrote Bengal's government. Today I must die so that India may live and may win freedom and glory. Taking the warning that Bose's death in custody could make him a highly inconvenient martyr, on December 5 local authorities released him to a loose house arrest. Once at home with his family, Bose disappeared from view for 2 weeks, pretending to be sick while secretly growing a beard to use as a disguise. His attempts to free India by political means having been thwarted, he had formulated a fresh goal, to seek military aid from Britain's enemies, the Axis powers. Such an opportunity as a world war was not to be squandered, he was certain. Early on January 17, 1941, Bose left his house, dressed as a Muslim insurance agent, and a nephew drove him all the way to Bihar province west of Bengal, where he boarded a train. After changing trains near Delhi, Bose finally disembarked in Peshawar in the northwest frontier province. There he met up with a Pakhtun associate, and decked in flowing turban and pyjamas and hastily trained in tribal etiquette, he trekked with a guide over frozen mountain passes into Afghanistan. That nation, cursed by cartography, sat neutral and uneasy between two warring powers, the British Empire and the Soviet Union, which at the time was allied with Nazi Germany. Arriving in Kabul on January 27, Bose approached the Soviet embassy, which demonstrated no interest in him. The German embassy, which cabled to Berlin and awaited instructions for what seemed like forever, and finally the Italian embassy. An official there informed Rome that the newcomer was intelligent, able, full of passion, and without doubt the most realistic of the Indian leaders. Berset was insisting that if 50,000 men, Italian, German or Japanese, could reach the frontiers of India, the Indian army would desert, the masses would uprise, and the end of English domination could be achieved in a very short time. According to the Italian cable, India was the secret fount of British military power, and therefore it was essential that Berset be rendered all the help he needed to realise his grand plan. In early April 1941, Subhas Chandra Berset arrived in Berlin in the guise of an Italian diplomat. Berset had taken a car and a train into the Soviet Union and flown to the German capital from there. He was fortunate in this choice of route because in March, after learning of his whereabouts and guessing his intentions, Britain's Special Operations Executive, SOE, had issued orders to assassinate him. The agents had assumed, however, that he would travel through Iran, Iraq, and Turkey to reach Germany. The war diary of the SOE noted that Amery was also interested and would no doubt lend his support to Berset being liquidated on Turkish territory if necessary. Such a venture was diplomatically risky because Turkey was neutral, but the Foreign Office consented to Berset being killed there. Given that the SOE was created by Churchill and was headed by Desmond Morton, one of his close associates, the order to kill Berset must have emanated from the very top. In his prison barracks in Midnapore, a coastal district in the southwestern corner of Bengal, 29-year-old Sushil Kumar Dara thrilled to the news of Berset's escape. "I was convinced that he'd gone toward Japan or Germany," Dara wrote in his autobiography. "If only he could get there, surely he would secure India's freedom." Like many others immersed in the independence struggle, Dara regarded the enemies of Britain as his friends. A village-level Congress worker like Dara planned and executed acts of civil disobedience while otherwise living his life and pursuing a calling in social service. Dara had been attending college in Calcutta when Gandhi had launched the Satyagraha movement. He was on Gandhi's select list of participants and, in the fall of 1940, had returned to Midnapore to await the word to launch his protest. In the meantime, one of Dara's duties was to beg for money from shopkeepers, collecting a coin here and a coin there until, at the end of an exhausting day, he might have a rupee to pay for food for himself and his co-workers. A rupee could buy a maund, or 37.4 kilograms, of coarse rice, and Dara's cell survived on around 25 rupees a month. Dara did the cooking himself, boiling rice and lentils together and flavouring the mixture with a bit of clarified butter or a donated vegetable. Soon after his arrival in Midnapore, his seniors had begun to visit marketplaces and give anti-war speeches. One by one they had been arrested. When it was his turn, Dara earned himself half a year in jail. Like many of his comrades, Sushil Dara had joined the Congress Party a decade earlier, during the protest movement known as the Salt Rebellion. In the spring of 1930, Gandhi had embarked on a long, winding trek that had taken him to Dandi, Gujarat, on the west coast of India. Reaching the sea on April 6, he had waded into the surf, picked up a handful of water, and set it onto the beach to dry, symbolically defying the law. The government of India had the exclusive right to manufacture and trade salt, and this monopoly, along with taxes, made the product hundreds of times more expensive than it would otherwise have been. The burden fell hardest on the poor, who lived by performing manual labour under a tropical sun, sweated profusely, and needed around 15 grams of salt a day to stave off heatstroke. In the early 18th century, the coastal district of Midnapore had supplied salt to all of eastern India and Nepal, but it had since become dependent on salt imported from England. the teenage Dara sitting cross-legged in the dust near an old temple just before the Salt Uprising, had listened wide-eyed as a Congress speaker had detailed the economic misadventure of India under colonial rule, and had been among the first to sign up. On April 6, 1930, thousands of protesters walked from the crumbling red brick palace at Tamluk, the region's most ancient town, to an inlet of the sea, there to boil water and make salt. From the second day onward, the police began to beat and jail the leaders of the movement, and Dara, too, was soon under arrest. Prison turned out to be instructive. The indulgent Indian jailer permitted Dara to visit restricted areas in the facility where members of a revolutionary outfit gave the youth books on armed insurrection and spent hours indoctrinating him. Gandhian thought had yet to leave much of a mark on me, Dara recounted, so their message of power mesmerized me. Everyone, including the English superintendent of the jail, seemed to treat these men, described as terrorists, with a respect that bordered on reverence, especially after the events of April 18, 1930. On that day, 65 rebels who called themselves the Indian Republican Army had seized control of a police armory and other strategic sites in Chittagong town in eastern Bengal. They had eventually retreated to a forested hill that the authorities had surrounded with troops and raked with machine gun fire. An unknown number of the rebels had died there, while others had escaped into surrounding villages and were being hunted down. Within weeks after the Salt Movement began, all of Midnapore's nationalist leaders were behind bars. But Bengal's officials reported to the viceroy that every villager was making salt in his home. The entire populace had lost its fear of the law. The police took to punishing dissidents by setting fire to huts, cowsheds, and the occasional gola, mini silo full of grain. An Indian civil servant protested to his superior, District Magistrate James Peddy, that the local people were behaving in a non-violent fashion. "This way you will be provoking them into violence." "That's what I want," replied Peddy, who had the power to adjust the level of force used by the police. "As long as they remain non-violent, it is very difficult for us. If they become violent, we can crush it in a day." Eventually, however, he developed misgivings about the strategy he was meant to implement. One incident illustrated his doubts. When his train stopped at a station, a boy on the platform caught sight of him and called out a freedom slogan. Peddy rushed up and punched him in the face, shouting, "Will you now stop?" "Wait, let me catch my breath," the boy gasped. "Then I'll do it again." "I never felt so small in my life as I did then," Peddy confided to a friend. Soon after that encounter, the viceroy summoned all district officers to meet with him in Calcutta, but Peddy refused to go. "Ask His Excellency," he instructed a colleague, "what more he expects me to do for his British Raj." In April 1931, James Peddy was shot dead by a revolutionary from a secretive cell in Midnapore town. Two other white district magistrates were also killed in quick succession. As a result, for the next decade, only native civil servants, selected for loyalty to crown and career, were appointed by the Raj to the most senior position in the district. Elsewhere in India, the uprising of 1930 surpassed that of 1920 in its pervasiveness and force. Peasants fled into neighbouring princely states to avoid paying rent. Women picketed liquor shops, from which the government earned